October, we're looking at what it is to give thanks. And we're just going to jump straight in, if we can, into the Bible. We're looking at Luke chapter 9, verses 10 to 17. And then I'm going to ask us a question. And then I want us to drill down a little bit, if we can, in the passage. It's one of those bits in the Bible where you can blink, you can miss it. So I really want to draw that out and then see what the Holy Spirit wants to do with us. So this is what it says. Luke chapter 9, verse 10. When the apostles returned, they reported to Jesus what they had done. Then he took them with him, and they withdrew by themselves to a town called Bethsaida. But the crowds learned about it and followed him. He welcomed them and spoke to them about the kingdom of God and healed those who needed healing. Later in the afternoon, the 12 came to him and said, "Send the crowd away so they can go to the surrounding villages and countryside and find food and lodging, because we're in a remote place here." He replied, "You give them something to eat." They answered, "We only have 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, unless we go and buy food for all this crowd." About 5,000 men were there. But he said to the disciples, "Have them sit in groups of about 50 each." The disciples did so, and everyone sat down. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and he broke them. Then he gave them to the disciples to distribute to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up the 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. This is the word of the Lord. So I want to ask you a question. Have you ever had a moment where you have felt overwhelmed? You've just thought, "Oh my goodness, how am I ever going to do this?" Have you ever had one of those moments? When I think about this story and I think about being totally overwhelmed, many, many things spring to mind. But the first thing I think springs to mind is about 22 years ago. I came here to Sheffield. I'd done a degree in the University of Hull. I did what was in those days called tribal training. We were here to study and to learn, and it was a discipleship year. So we're thinking, what does it mean to become more like Jesus? And one of the guys who taught us and invested in us was a man by the name of Martin Garner, who was the most incredible evangelist. And he was so infectious for God. And he was the kind of guy that wherever he went, he could start a conversation with somebody and he could lead them to the Lord. Just a beautiful, beautiful man. Now with Jesus, but a beautiful, beautiful man. And I was in his what's called a huddle, which is about 6 of us would meet with him twice a week. And he essentially discipled us. And one day he said, "We're going to go onto the streets of Park Hill Flats and we're going to go knocking on doors and we're going to talk to people and ask if they want to follow Jesus." Now, I'd grown up in the church, so we're used to talking about it, and we're used to praying about it, and sometimes we're really good at knowing what the Greek says about it, but we didn't do it. And so he said, "We're going to go out in the streets," and we said, "Are you sure, Martin? Do you think we should pray a little bit more and see if it's really God's will for us to go out on the streets? And I think it may rain next week, so it might be a sign from Jesus that we shouldn't go out. We should still just immerse ourselves in the Greek." And he's such an infectious, beautiful man. He said, "No, let's go and I'll drive you. I'll drive us all there." And we piled into his Seat Toledo. What a great car they were. And he was wearing a hat with Jesus on it. He got it from Jesus College, Cambridge. But he wore it because it was about Jesus. And he wanted to talk to people about Jesus. And so he had his Jesus hat on. And we were cringing it just felt so cringy. And he said, "Guys, we're just going to go and do it." And he'd not made any printouts. There was no laminated cards to say to take people through the prayer. He just said, "Let's just trust the Holy Spirit. Let's go for it." And so we crammed into the Seat Toledo. Now, if you've never been to Park Hill Flats, 20 years ago, Park Hill Flats was not the up-and-coming hipster central that it is today. It was a bit rough. So we were walking around talking to people about the Lord, and there's lots of stuff going on. Some people thought we were there to buy drugs. We weren't. We were there to talk about the Lord. And it was absolutely terrifying. It wasn't the most terrifying thing. But when I think about it, it was absolutely scary. Just going up to random people and say, "Hello, we're Christians and we'd love to talk to you about Jesus." Or knocking on doors. It was like we were knocking the doors thinking, "Who's going to open the door? What are they going to do?" It was really scary. And there's something that happens, isn't there, when we sense we're to do something, I can often feel like because I feel overwhelmed, or it's really vulnerable when you rock up on Park Hill Flats and you're not quite sure what you're doing, but you know you're going to talk to people about Jesus. That sense of vulnerability. If I could go back 18 years and say to my 22-year-old self, what I would love to say is just because you feel overwhelmed does not disqualify you from doing what it is that God is asking you to do. Because I think it is really easy when we feel overwhelmed, or we feel disqualified, or we become so aware of our vulnerabilities that somehow we're deficient and we're not walking by faith. But it's that sense that we're aware sometimes of our vulnerabilities. I can remember after leaving Sheffield the first time, I was going to London for a job. I knew three people. I remember the first day going to work, I'm on the tube thinking, what am I doing? This total feeling of being overwhelmed, of totally vulnerable. I remember when our first, just before we got married, I remember talking to a good friend of mine thinking, have I made the right decision? It just feels, and I remember the day of my wedding with my best man, Jimmy, thinking, I'm sure I should be really excited about this and it's going to be great, but I just feel totally overwhelmed. I remember when our daughter was born and we were holding this tiny, beautiful life thinking, when are her parents going to come and get her? Oh no, that is us. What the heck do you do? And when she starts pooing, what on earth do you do? And it's just like, what do we do? I remember when we left Cambridge, we were living in Cambridge for, to move to Sheffield, and all of our stuff was in a removal van. And there's just me and we had two kids at the time, and they're playing with a big box. And all of our possessions were in the back of a lorry, and we knew we were moving back to Sheffield. And that just, that sense of feeling totally vulnerable, totally overwhelmed. Jesus, are we absolutely making the right decision here? And it is easy to feel that and think, God, somehow, can you really use me when I feel this way? I want us to think, if we can, about this incredible story. Jesus feeds the 5,000. It's pretty famous. If you grew up in the church and you went to Sunday school or kids' church, as it's called these days here, it's one of those stories that we remember. It actually starts in the early part of Luke chapter 9 when Jesus is sending out his 12 followers. Rather like us packing into Martin Garner's Say at Toledo, Jesus has been called to him 12 people and he's invested the entirety of his life and then he sends them out. Go out and do it. And in verse 3 he says, take nothing for the journey, no staff or staff if from the south, no bag, no bread, no money, no extra shirts. Whatever house you enter, stay there until you leave that town. Take nothing, no cash, no bag, no tuning, no sense of clothing. A couple of weeks ago, I lost my wallet in Broomhill, and the first I heard about it is when I got a text from the bank to say, have you spent all these transactions? I hadn't spent those transactions at all. And for a few days, I had no wallets. I'd got no cards because I'd cancelled them. And it's that sense of quite vulnerable. And people were really kind and said, look, we can lend you cash. And it was a weird thing to receive from people saying, we'll lend you stuff. And Jesus is sending out his disciples. And he's saying, take nothing for the journey, no staff, no bag. Take nothing where you can rely on your own resources, where you can rely on your own provision. He's sending them out saying, I'm going to send you out and I'm going to take away the very thing that your comfort blanket. I'm not going to send you with a load of cash in case it all goes bad. I'm going to send you out. And in this context and in this culture, you were reliant on the hospitality of other people. So he was saying, go out, I will provide for you. You need to trust me. Rely totally on God's provision. That is a really vulnerable place to be in. But how we feel the vulnerability is the flip side of faith. And then what we hear as we get into the passage that we're looking at, because it's really important to cue that up, because that's what I believe that Jesus is teaching the followers. When we get to verse 10, it says the apostles returned and they reported to Jesus all that they had done. And then Jesus does what he does. He then takes them with him and they go to retreat. And often we talk about the language in our church of doing the things that Jesus does and living the lifestyle of Jesus. I find it really interesting in a really noisy, charismatic church as we are, that one of the things Jesus does, and he does it with his followers, is they go and retreat. They go and take deliberate space. They go away from the familiar and retreat to be away from the busyness of life. And they'll go and be alone with the Lord. And I find that a massive challenge. And it makes me ask the question, if I'm serious and want to follow the lifestyle of him, where in my pattern of my life am I genuinely taking time to be with him? And I would want to say I'm not brilliant at that. It's something that I'm working on more and more. But I think it's something that Jesus does. And if he does it and it's in the book, then there's an invitation for us to do it as well. And I don't know whether you're here, you love a good plan, but this retreat is an absolute dog's dinner. Because as they get to Bethsaida, or just beyond that, thousands of people turn up. So it's a kind of funny retreat, right? Thousands of people rock up and want to speak to Jesus. And Jesus, being who he is, doesn't send them away, doesn't say, sorry, folks, you're not with the program here. There's a plan, and you're wrecking it. There is a plan for a retreat, and you guys are crashing the party. He embraces them, and he talks with them. How are you when God interrupts your plans? When life is segmented and compartmentalized? How does it work out? Do you feel vulnerable? Feel like somehow you're not quite in control? And then they turn up, and something remarkable happens. Jesus heals, he teaches, and then the 12 come to him and say, send the crowd away, so then go to the surrounding villages and countryside and find food and lodging, because we are in a remote place here. Now, why is that significant? It's significant because the 12 know that the followers, the 5,000, we're told it's 5,000 men. That means it could be 5,000 men. It could be about 9,000 people in total. Because what Luke tells us is he only tells us about the men. We don't know about women and we don't know about the children. So it could be a lot more. But they know that if they were to go to the local villages, to the local places of habitation, that they would find a warm welcome and they would find that they could receive hospitality. It's a really practical solution to a really practical issue. How can we provide food for all these people? And then Jesus says something remarkable in verses 13. He says this, you give them something to eat. You give them something to eat. I mean, it is absolutely ridiculous. What an incredulously ridiculous thing to say. How can they do that? They've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. And they respond to Jesus by this, we have only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Unless we go and buy food for all this crowd, about 5,000 men were there. So there's something going on here, and this is what I want us to think about. Either the disciples are being really sarky, they say, well, do you want us to go and buy food? Or they've got money. So they're either saying, well, we've got money, do you want us to pop to the shops? I'm not sure we've got enough for everybody. Or is it sarky? Well, either way, if it's sarky, I wouldn't be sarky with Jesus, probably not a great idea. And if they've got money, that's not cool, because he said earlier in verse 3, don't take nothing for the journey, no staff, no bag, no bread, no money. And interestingly, they've taken lunch on their journey, which is the food that they've got is their lunch. So they're saying, do you want us to go sort it or what? And then he says this, so he said to the disciples, have each of them sit down in groups of 50. The disciples did so, and everyone sat down. Now, why does Jesus tell them to organize them? Well, it throws back to something that every person, the 5,000 gathered, whether it's the 5,000 men or it's more including women and children, as they sit down into this organization of 50, it kind of reminds them of the stories they would have heard as the followers of God, the Jewish people, would have left Egypt making their way to the promised land. And as we know from the stories, Exodus in Numbers, that as the kind of thousands of people migrated, and we see some of this stuff now, don't we? We've seen in Europe in recent years, masses and masses of people migrating from one place to another. Well, in the ancient times, that was not unusual. And as the people of God are migrating, they have left behind a life in Egypt. They have nothing. And so God provides for them manna, like little flakes of bread, that every morning they wake up, rain or shine. The God in heaven who loves them and has called them has said that he will provide for them. And then we see that in Exodus that God provides, and we see Numbers, they're able to take this, fashion it, and survive on it. That the God who loves them and is for them will provide for them. So Jesus is stepping into this kind of prophetic history over the generations. And as he says to the disciples, sit them down in groups of 50, it has echoes of God's provision to their ancestors. The Bible says here that the disciples did so and everyone sat down. Now, it's really interesting. When somebody asks us to do something, there is a major temptation to look at our own internal resources. That's exactly what the disciples do. When people have asked me to do things, I know that my immediate thing is to think, well, what can I actually do this? When I've sensed God's call on my life, I haven't thought, well, Lord, thank you for speaking to me this amazing way. I've often thought, you know, Lord, I cannot do this. When we're presented with a call, when we're presented with an invitation, the temptation is to look inwards and see if we can respond and we can fulfill and walk out that calling. I know that I am so aware of all my junk. Those who know me well are also aware of my failings. I know that I'm aware of my failings, my insecurities. I kind of think that I have huge sympathy for the disciples. I mean, they've just seen Jesus do miracles. I've seen some amazing stuff over the years, God do amazing things. And then it's as if I forget. And Jesus says to them, sit these guys down. And then he takes these loaves and he looks up to heaven and he gives thanks and he breaks it. Bread is so significant in the Bible. In fact, Jesus says he's the bread of life. But to the Jewish people, bread is really, really, really important. Every time you would have a meal in that world at that time, you would break bread. Why would you break bread? Because bread would represent that you and I, we're not just self-sufficient. That we rely on a whole world around us. Bread. You would make bread. You may buy the ingredients for bread. You won't just go to Tesco and buy it. We are here. The Bible is revealing to us a culture that is totally connected to the ecosystems around us. We live in a world now, we're just waking up to that. It's taken a 15-year-old Swede, Greta Thunberg, to awaken a generation. Your generation is far more aware of it than my generation. And certainly, sorry fellas, the generations that are beyond us. There is a sense of a climate awareness, a sense in which we have to realize that the world around us we rely on. And for too long, we've lived not thinking like that. That's hence why every time you break bread, because bread would remind people that as the bread is broken, you give thanks for the person who's break the bread. You give thanks for the person who has made the bread. There was a deep consciousness that we are connected to the world around us. And a deep consciousness that we need other people to provide for us. That we're not just individuals, that we need other people. And so Jesus breaks the bread. The bread, the symbol of provision. The bread, the symbol of connection. And he looks up to heaven. Psalm 121. I lift my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? Jesus lifts his eyes to the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth, and stands as this great benefactor. It's a culture where if you needed something, it would be given to you. It's a culture of hospitality. If you were hungry, somebody would feed you. And Jesus is standing in that moment. He's breaking the bread. He's looking up to heaven. And by the most incredible, miraculous move of God, 5,000 people, we are told by Luke, and it's also repeated in the other Gospels, are fed. It is the most remarkable story. And within it, it tells us two things about God's remarkable provision. It awakens the reality that God has always provided for his people. And it awakens something much deeper. Because not only does the bread connect us to one another, not only does bread make us grateful for the world that has provided that, the ecosystems, whatever it might be, they are eating together. Now, why is that an issue? We've just done a whole series over the summer on eating together. Well, this is a culture that people don't just eat together because some people are unclean. Some people, not just in the sense that they smell, but they're ritually unclean. Some people will be really serious about their faith. Some people will be less serious about their faith. And some of those people would not want to mix. And so here's Jesus functioning as this incredible benefactor and saying, I will feed people. You will eat together. You are now included. To those who will be there, who are listening to Jesus, who are desperate to hear from him, desperate to be healed, maybe having disease, they wouldn't eat with other people. Because if you're diseased, you could make that other person unclean. It's a really divided society. Like we live in a divided society, I believe. Are you Brexit or you Remain? Families don't talk about it anymore. So divided. This is a culture that's the very definition of a divided society. And here is Jesus unifying people together. I don't know how you've come to church today, whether it's the more, whether last night you did stuff and you wish you hadn't done it, or there's repeating patterns that you can't change. What this tells us is that Jesus' phenomenal generosity says this: to the person struggling with porn, you're welcome. To the person working out their sexuality, you're welcome. To the person who is struggling with sex, you're welcome. To the person who doesn't like themselves, you're welcome. Come and eat with Jesus, the King of Kings. You are welcome. It is both his generosity and the feeding is also his most remarkable, beautiful, unifying grace. In a culture where if I do something for Liam, the expectation is he does something for me. There is no such thing in this culture as a free lunch. But for Jesus, it's totally free. And you see, folks, it's a symbol, a sign that he is the provider, the one who provided from the very beginning, from the beginning of time. And in that moment, he is the one that now welcomes and includes those who are the outsiders, those upon the edge, that he will provide. That he is gracious, that he is loving, that he is welcoming. And in that moment, it's a sign because it's totally free. It's God's free gift to his people. That is the significance of the bread, and that is the significance of those fish. It symbolizes both God's grace and his provision. When I went to theological college in 2005, I went to a place called Wycliffe Hall in Oxford, and I have a photo of me standing next to a friend of mine, and we're queuing up outside the Sheldonian Theatre, and I'm wearing what's called subfusc, which is essentially like a weird kind of graduation type vibe. And we're queuing up to go to the Sheldonian Theatre right in the heart of Oxford for a ceremony. It's called a matriculation ceremony. So when you start Oxford University, you matriculate at the beginning of your time. And it's in Latin. So we matriculated. And it's an intimidating place. It's a little bit like Hogwarts. You know, old buildings, very clever people. You know, you do the tour. C.S. Lewis was here and this person's here. My friend saw Richard Dawkins twice there. Both times he fell off his bike. He thought it was the Lord. I don't know whether that's true or not. Anyway. But it's quite an intimidating place, and I was training to be a vicar, and I was with some really gifted people. A lot of them had been to either boarding school. That's not my background. A lot had been to Oxford or Cambridge as undergraduates. I went to all. Hey, come on. And I began to sense this is God's call on my life. And often, certainly from my experience, I can only speak from my experience, but I find it a temptation to look within. And as I'm starting the process, as we're learning, we've matriculated, we're in it now. It's what's called Michaelmas term. And I just have this overwhelming sense of, oh no, these guys are just awesome. They're way better than me. They write essays really well and they speak really clearly and they all sound really posh. I'm from the West Midlands. They even sound properly, these people. Lord, you must have made a mistake. Did you really choose me to do this, Lord? That sense of feeling totally overwhelmed. And like the disciples, when you feel overwhelmed, it's so easy to look internally, isn't it? Well, compared to others, I found it really hard. And I wrote an email to a lovely, lovely man who was a godsend to me, really, the whole time I was there. And he just simply sent me an email back that said this. He quotes from 2 Corinthians, "My grace is sufficient, for my power is made perfect in weakness." Through that email and through conversation with that man and with others, I began to realize that God calls us and God provides. God's grace is sufficient. In the same way that God calls his followers not to rely upon themselves, to embrace that vulnerability and to bring it to the Lord. That's exactly how I felt when I was training to become a vicar. As I compared myself with others, and that's always a really dangerous thing to do. So a wise person once said to me, comparison is the enemy of confidence. And I've said that loads of times. And manage your expectations, I'm going to say it a lot more times because I think it's really helpful. That as facing other people, facing the call, I began to look inwards. And as I began to look inwards, I began to think that I can't do this. And I think I used to think back then that low self-esteem was the same as humility. I've come to realize that humility is not the same. The American leader, Rick Warren, says that humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. There is a subtle difference. Humility isn't thinking less of yourself, like insecurity, it's thinking of yourself less. You see, I had got into a bit of a rut where I was drawn to comparison with others and started to think, God, I don't think you can do this with me. I don't think you can use me because look, these guys are so better than me. And I started to develop in my heart, it was hard to trust the Lord because in some senses, I thought I knew better than Jesus. How can you use me, Lord? And I felt gently the Spirit of God begin to change in me some thinking, which went like this, trust me. Don't lean on your own understanding. The vulnerabilities you feel are good because actually the Apostle Paul, he tells us he felt vulnerable. And the Lord used him powerfully. That we are called, like the disciples, to recognize God's provision, to recognize our own vulnerabilities, but to see that we can trust him. And part of the way that we do that is by allowing the Lord into our lives, to recognizing God's grace to us, recognizing that I cannot do it in my own strength, recognizing that in Jesus I rest and we rest upon his grace and we rely upon his power. And as we end this season of saying thank you, this season of thanksgiving, as we remember that Jesus died for us, that his grace reaches out to us and frees us, we embrace hearts of gratitude. And what overflows out of our hearts of gratitude is words of thanksgiving. And for me, as I reflected all those years ago, when I was trained to be a vicar, and I'm not free of it, always I have to remind myself of it, is this, that we look back and see God's grace, and we call to mind with gratitude every day God's blessings and his benefits, and we do that by looking at his provision in our lives. So I'm not sure how you are today with the Lord, whether you've come to church and you feel, I don't know, a sense of disconnection from him. We would love to pray for you now, that today you can reconnect back with the Lord, receive his forgiveness, be filled with the Holy Spirit.